I've been thinking a lot about my grandfather recently. A mountain of a man, 6'4", with a long gait and a broad smile and huge oil rigger hands. For the first 6 years of my life, our family had a market garden on the shores of Jackfish Lake in Saskatchewan. And my grandparents would come and visit us often. My grandmother would make a mess in the kitchen, making prune buns and these weird and wobbly jellied salads, and her famous lemon meringue pie, which only recently came out of a box. But my grandfather was not much of an inside person. He had an adventurer's heart. He would take me exploring, or as I put it back then, splorin', in the hill country behind our house. "Grandpa, Grandpa, let's go splorin'," I would say. And we would disappear for hours, just the two of us. And we would rub sage between our hands and talk to the birds and find shapes in clouds and pick wildflowers and feast on Saskatoon berries. We would talk, but often our words were too restrictive for the expansiveness of our imaginations. High above the ordinary, ours was the realm of adventure and quest, cresting each hill with wonder and curiosity with what we might find there. Perhaps we would find a troll or a dragon or the most magical creature of all, at least for me, a cow. What might we find over the next hill, we would wonder. Those days with my grandfather in the high places of my childhood were defined not by what was, but by what could be, by what was possible. He died when I was 14, but those days together on the hills beside the lake shaped me and continue to shape me. And now how I now shape the experiences of my boys in the hill country of their childhood. And because of that, and because of them, I think about my grandfather a lot. High places like hills and mountains are important places in the Bible. After the flood, Noah's Ark came to ground on a mountain. Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac on a mountain. Moses received the commandments from God on a mountain. Solomon's temple was built on a mountain. Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal on a mountain. Jesus was transfigured on a mountain. The Sermon on a Mount, mountain. Over and over again, God's character and intentions are revealed on mountains. So here's a Bible study pro tip for you. If something happens on a mountain, it's probably really important. And so in our John reading this morning, where it says that Jesus goes up a mountain not once but twice, we know that something vital is happening here. As we heard last week, the great crowds are following Jesus and the disciples. They started out down at the lakeshore, and now they have followed them up the mountain. 5,000 in total, we are told. Just imagine the sight of that. 5,000 people, the population of Gravenhurst, climbing up a mountain, many of them sick or carrying their sick with them. Waves of need trampling through waves of grass as they climb ever closer to the one they hope will bring healing and comfort. It must have been quite the sight. Overwhelming, intimidating even. And Jesus, who has been preparing his disciples for the time when they will need to carry the movement forward without him, recognizes that this is a teachable moment. And so he puts them to the test. He asks Philip, "Where are we to buy bread for these people to eat?" And the ever pragmatic Philip pauses, scans the crowd, scratches his head, and says, "I just can't imagine how that's possible. 6 months' wages, Lord, would not buy enough bread for each of them to even get a little." And then a boy emerges from the crowd, and another disciple, Andrew, says to Jesus, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they among so many people? It's just not enough." When presented with the challenge of extreme need, the disciples respond with, "We don't have enough and we can't get enough. It's just not possible, Jesus." Faced with need, the disciples respond with an attitude of cynicism and scarcity. And because of this, simply put, they failed the test. It's not always easy to know what to do with the miracle stories in Scripture, like the feeding of the 5,000. Blind faith, just believing that it happened exactly as written, can be unsatisfying because it doesn't line up with our own experience. Likewise, complete skepticism or trying to explain away what happened on that mountainside as an ordinary occurrence. One interpretation is that the people simply started sharing the food that they had, but this strips all the wonder out of the story. It strips out all possibility for mystery. It puts us in a mindset of spiritual scarcity. And in the face of overwhelming need, it sets us up to fail when our own resources run out. The better way, I believe, of approaching stories like this is to look for meaning that can be seen through archetypal patterns. Reading the story of the 5,000 in isolation, it is easy to fall into the skeptic versus supernaturalist camps. But when we elevate our perspective and see this story in relation to other stories, patterns emerge about God, God's character, and God's intentions for this world. With perspective, we see that the feeding of the 5,000 echoes the story of 2 Kings that Gunn read for us, where Elisha miraculously feeds 100 prophets in a time of famine. And both stories echo the ancient narrative of the Exodus, where God hears the cries of the Israelites in Egypt, frees them from their bondage, and provides all the sustenance they would need in their wilderness journey in the form of manna from heaven. The Exodus, Elisha and the 100, Jesus and the 5,000, all archetypal accounts of divine abundance, of more than enough being provided in times of apparent scarcity. Again and again, God hears, God provides, God shows what is possible. Climbing to the high places of faith to get perspective, we see that Scripture often works in this way, with multiple narrative layers, one on top of the other, revealing deep connections with the most foundational stories in the biblical treasury. And the implicit invitation in these stories is for us to consider the details of our own lives in the same way. What echoes do we hear in the experiences of our ancestors in the faith to what we experience today? When faced with an overwhelming challenge, does the reply of Philip sound familiar to you? No way. There's no way we can afford that. Or what about the words of Andrew? There's no way this will work. There's no point even trying. Have you heard that before? Have you said that before? What we see displayed here in the attitude of the disciples is a warning against cynicism. It is a critique against a culture that has lost the ability to wonder and dream and imagine what might be possible. A people who have grown cynical, who have lost the ability to be curious and explore what they are afraid of, will likely miss the extraordinary embedded alongside the ordinary. They will likely miss out on the miracle. With an attitude of cynicism and a worldview defined by scarcity, there is no quest, no adventure. Possibilities slam shut around us. And in these days, defined by the climate crisis and mass extinctions and conspiracy theories and social unraveling, and it is this pervasive attitude of cynicism that scares me the most. As a dad of two boys who will inherit this mess, it is this attitude that says, no, we can't afford it, or no, we can't possibly do it, that scares me the most. Because the inevitable outcome of a worldview defined by scarcity is hopelessness. It is despair. It is famine. And so we turn back to our text today for another way, another voice. One of Jesus' disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "Here is a boy who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Here is a boy who, like the disciples, has seen the need but has brought an entirely different attitude. He comes with an entirely different worldview. He presents what he has to Jesus, loaves and fish, with faith and trusts that it will be enough. Here is the dreamer. Here is the one who sees what is possible and is willing to contribute to it and is willing to sacrifice for it. Here is the one who still believes in the extraordinary, in mystery and miracles. Here is the one for whom cynicism and scarcity has not stripped the wonder out of life. Here is the one who still has an adventurer's heart. It is this boy who sees the possibility of his offering in the hands of Jesus. Into the hands of Jesus, he gives what he has and trusts that it will be enough. And it is he who passes the test." When something happens on a mountain, you know that it's important. And so when presented with the offering from this boy, Jesus demonstrates that in his hands, not enough is never the final answer. John tells us that after telling the crowds to sit down, he first gives thanks and then distributes the bounty of the boy's offering to all who hunger. The Greek word here for giving thanks is eucharistos. This wondrous mountainside meal is the Eucharist, where the ordinary things of life become extraordinary, and all who approach are fed. This is the living bread, the never-ending bounty that Jesus continually offers through his life, death, and resurrection. From that mountainside 2,000 years ago, through the mystery of faith, Jesus just keeps giving thanks and keeps feeding all who hunger. Even today, it is a meal we can return to and count on for nourishment. In the ordinary things of life, it is the extraordinary hidden in plain view. It is a reminder of what is possible in Jesus' hands and by God's grace. I sometimes wonder what happened to the boy with the loaves and fish. John goes on to tell that after the people were satisfied, they tried to seize him by force and make him their king. They didn't really understand what happened that day. They saw Jesus not as the one who embodies God's abundant, nourishing grace, but rather as a powerful wonder worker who could satisfy all their needs, fix all their problems, and lead them to a military victory over their imperial oppressors. It is the worldview of scarcity all over again, and when confronted with it, Jesus retreats higher up the mountains by himself this time. I wonder what happened to the boy. Maybe he got caught up in the mob think of the crowds. Maybe he too saw Jesus as a spiritual vending machine where need goes in and satisfaction comes out. But I don't think so. I like to think he went searching for Jesus that day and continued to search for him in the high country of his childhood, because that's what people with adventurous hearts do. Just over the next hill. Just over the next hill. I bet he continued to dream wondrous dreams and find shapes in clouds and talk to birds and feast on wild berries. I bet he never stopped being curious about what was possible. I imagine him climbing above cynicism and scarcity into the high places, the divine places of abundance and beauty and meaning and wonder. I imagine him coming to see not just loaves and fish, but his whole life as an offering into the hands of Jesus. I imagine him being a full and active participant in the endless Eucharist that feeds all who hunger with the food that will never perish. In time, I imagine him sharing all that he has learned and all that he has experienced with his children and then his grandchildren. I imagine him cresting a hill, cutting long strides through deep grass, and then a broad smile breaking onto his kind face when he hears his grandson cry out behind him, "Grandpa, Grandpa, let's go splorin'."